Lois McMaster Bujold, and I write science fiction and fantasy, mostly novels. I've done very little short work. I've completed 24 books, all of which are still in print in one form or another, or in pixels at least. Started the work that became the professional work in 1982. It was first published in 1986, and then things flowed from there.
What's about your beginnings as a writer? Were you knee-high to a grasshopper, or was it 2 weeks ago?
Well, it certainly wasn't 2 weeks ago. I have kind of two answers to that. One is the stuff I was doing sort of before I became a writer, as a proto-writer, and I really started that in about eighth grade, where I was writing imitation my favorite stuff, which we would now call fanfic. I don't think that term was quite there in 1965. And I had a good friend in high school. We used to write for each other. We would make up stories, you know, some of which never hit paper. And we developed this long, elaborate family tree and this whole saga over a couple of years. And then we went our respective ways. She went off to college. I went off to college at Ohio State. And somewhere in that period, I got married and I lost track of wanting to be a writer. You know, it's kind of disappeared off my radar. And I spent about 10 years working at Ohio State University Hospitals as a drug administration technician, which is like a nurse's aide who gives medications, everything except IVs, up and down the nursing unit. And that turned out to be important for me later, just because of the sheer amount of human observation I had in little bits along the way. Not only of patients, but of myself, of the staff, how the whole system worked. Watching the technology of modern medicine trying to get through to this millions of years old design of human beings, trying to get past the interface. So that later informed my writing to a very great degree. But it was like all unconsciously assimilated at the time. And then in my early 30s, I was in a small town in Ohio, Marion, Ohio, with two small children and no job. This would have been the early 1980s, 1981, 2. When there was a recession going on. This is not a new phenomenon. Recessions are, you know, very familiar, and no jobs to be had, and certainly no jobs to be had that would pay a babysitter. So my friend Lillian, from back in high school, had also completed her family and also started writing again. And she had sent out short stories. She was working on a novel, and she made some short story sales to the science fiction magazines, Asimov's, I think. And maybe fantasy and science fiction, I don't remember at this late date. And I thought, gosh, we used to do this together. Maybe I could do this at home with the kids and make some money and, you know, pay some bills. This would work in my context. So I sat down and started writing. I did a novelette for practice, you know, thinking about, you know, what should I write? And it's, you know, what I could come up with, sort of out of my head, the end of 1982. And I sent it to Lillian to critique. She now lives in, or she then lived in Dallas, Texas. And this was in the era before word processors, of course, not that I could have afforded one if they had existed. So copies were made by typing it into carbon copies, you know, carbon copy. And she read it, and she made some comments and wrote back, which was like, cool. And then she says, by the way, I met somebody at a recent convention who might give you a really good letter of critique or comment, and she gave me Patricia Reedy's address, which is how we met, because Lillian had met her at a convention and said, send it to Pat, she'll give it a good critique. So I dutifully, you know, sent off my little novelette, and Pat sent back a 14-page letter of critique, which was like wonderful. It was more attention than I'd had from one human being in years. Yeah.
So, anything not to write that one page, yeah. Huh?
It reminds me of my daughter's remark on the stray cat. Mom, I fed it, but it won't go away. Gosh. So Pat, of course, was rewarded with the next bit, which was the start of the book that eventually became my first novel, Shards of Honor, through a lot of, you know, a lot of changes before we finally got there. So that was, you know, that was kind of how my career started. I sat down and started writing because I needed the money, and I was trapped in a situation where there were, you know, the other solutions were not available. It took a while. It was 3 years from, you know, from the time that I started writing to the time that I actually started selling, and that was the longest 3 years of my life.
Yeah.
with the small children, trying to write, knowing I was writing, not knowing if it was any good, not knowing if it was saleable, but just keeping on. Wrote the novel that became Shards of Honor, it was called Mirrors back then, in 1983. The one that became The Warrior's Apprentice in 1984, and the one that became Ethan of Athos in 1985, 1, 2, 3, and sent chapters as they came off the typewriter to Pat and Lillian, and we sort of ended up in this round robin writer's workshop by mail, where we would critique each other, and I learned a lot from both being critiqued and from having to do critiquing. You know, we were kind of bootstrapping ourselves up and teaching each other as we went. During that period, I was also trying to do short stories because, you know, they keep telling you, write short stories as practice for your novel, which works fine if you're a natural short story writer, but not so good if you're a natural novelist.
That's right.
Different disciplines there. But one of those sold to Twilight Zone magazine toward the end of 1984. That was enormously encouraging. It wasn't very much money, but you know, somebody, a real editor, had bought me, and I knew I had beaten out 7,000 other entries to get chosen.
And now you had credentials.
And now I had at least a credential. Yes. You know, a credential. It was worth it. Put it into every cover letter thereafter. And then after several rejections, The Warrior's Apprentice arrived back at me, and Lillian again said, I met this editor at a convention, Betsy Mitchell, from a new company, Bain Books. Why don't you try it on her? Because that's, yeah, it's kind of the stuff they publish. In any case, she's a nice woman and might give you a more helpful letter of critique than what you have gotten so far. I said, okay, we'll try it on Betsy. And I sent it off to Bain in the late summer of 1985. It got past the first reader, got past Betsy, got to Jim Bain. There was some lettering back and forth because we mentioned the other two novels, the one that was almost finished and the one that was floating around in submissions here and there. And in October of 1985, Jim Bain called me on the phone and bought all three books, which was the most stunning phone call I've ever had. I had no idea what a publisher was at this point. You know, my idea of publishers were like, you know, they live in towers in New York, you know, with the great red eye at the top, you know, looking out for books, and the engines of destruction in the basement churn out books. It's like not the way it works. It's actually like six people in an office and a large bottle of Maalox, you know, yes. What a publishing company is, really. But yeah, I had all these visions. So it was a very surreal conversation from my point of view. He may have had experience talking with newbie writers, but I had none talking with publishers or purchasing editors. But somehow or other, we got the books into contract, and he brought them all out in 1986, 1, 2, 3, which was, you know, I thought, space them out, make them last, I don't write that fast.
Yeah.
But it turned out to be very good in the long run because it made me very visible very quickly. And so I was a smart marketer.
And people read faster than writers write.
Oh yeah, they sure do.
Yeah.
So, labor for a year to get this thing out, and they write back, I finished it in 2 hours, where's the next one?
What about your reading habits as a kid? Were you an avid reader?
Oh yeah. I was not a precocious reader. I learned to read, you know, with the rest of my school age class, you know, Cedic Run and all that. Very boring. But about second or third grade, I found out that when you were taken down to the library cafeteria for library period, you didn't have to just take the books laid out on the table for your age group. You could take any book out, you know. And so my reading level immediately jumped to sixth grade as I dove into all the horse books I could get.
Horse books, yeah. Yes.
Walter Farley, Marguerite Henry,
yeah.
All of those things, because I was horse crazy at that period. So I burned through all of those very quickly, and you know, my reading level jumped up as high as whatever I was reading was.
What about science fiction?
Science fiction came a little later. There had been some kicking around in my school libraries. I can remember reading The Visit to the Mushroom Planet by Eleanor Cameron, I think her name was, which turns out to be an book for all kinds of science fiction writers of my generation. A lot of people read those. I loved those. But I started reading adult science fiction when I was about 9 because my dad would buy it when he went on the plane on consulting trips. You know, he would pick up magazines or paperbacks or anthologies, which you could buy in airplane bookstore, airport bookstores back in those days, and bring them home, and these would fall to me. And so I was reading Robert Sheckley and William Tenn and Ray Bradbury and other things that he had been reading. And then I sort of expanded out into the libraries that I could reach. You know, burned through the Clark and Heinlein and Asimov that were in my school libraries. And then I went to the, you know, the public libraries, of which there were 1, 2, 3 that I could get to if I could persuade my mother to drive me there. And sort of the science fiction sections were much smaller in those days, and I kind of read through and found, you know, everything I could get. Elsbeth de Camp, I was writing him, and his Fletcher Pratt, he was collaborating with. And they were doing, and another writer that I read very early on was Eric Frank Russell, who's British. But both of these writers particularly had humor in their stories. And I really, really like that. I think that's what I imprinted on most, is the funny science fiction. You know, uh-huh. the stuff that, you know, that had wit and was not, you know, downer, dystopic stuff. Although I read that too. I read all the... In the 1960s, it was all World War III dystopias. You know, so it was all going to be post-Holocaust, you know, scrambling in the ruins, you know, fighting the mutants for the canned goods.
Did you get hooked on Twilight Zone?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's another story from my childhood. Yeah. Rod Serling actually used to be at the same television station my dad worked as a weatherman at. He was moonlighting as a weatherman. He was a professor during the day that did the weather show on WBNS-TV Channel 10 at night. But anyway, yeah, Twilight Zone came on. It came on exactly at my bedtime, which was 10 o'clock. So I would pretend to go to bed, sneak down, turn on the little black and white TV in the back room as low as I could hear it, you know, and watch until somebody came and took me away and sent me back to bed. So I have a lot of interrupted Twilight Zone stories. Yeah. But yeah, that was very early on, and that was indeed one of the first influences.
Talk about how you actually write. What is it you do?
All right. Well, for me, the making it up and the writing it down are two separate processes. For some writers, they are simultaneous. You know, they sit at the computer, they generate ideas, it kind of flows out their fingers, and it's very efficient, I'm sure. But it does not work that way for me. I have to work up my ideas separately. And I make notes in a pencil and a notebook and collect them until they reach a certain critical mass. It depends whether we're talking about whether I'm just booting up a book or whether I'm, you know, in process in a book. There's similarities and differences. When I'm in process in a book, I've got the flow going, I have a certain amount behind me which, you know, suggests what comes ahead. And I'll work out my scenes, what happens next, up to a point where I don't know what happens next. I call that an event horizon. And I can write up to that point without knowing, you know, this next critical decision. And while I'm writing, the ideas keep churning and coming up, and, you know, it becomes a continuous flow process. And when I arrive there, either I've figured it out or I have to stop and think for a little bit, or several weeks sometimes. When I'm first booting up a book, it's kind of similar. I collect ideas, I have some idea of this sort of visceral feeling of, you know, where the book is going to be. This is going to be a book. Start to generate the characters who start to generate everything else. I usually start with characters, but I have started with both plot and setting in different books and develop them, you know, in different orders. The first Miles book, The Warrior's Apprentice, started with Miles, but he himself came out of his parents' situation from a prior book. The Spirit Ring came from reading a book on old folk tales, which was about an old folk tale that I thought should, you know, be worthy of being turned back into an adult fantasy novel. So that started with the plot, and then the characters were brought in, and then the world grew around it. And I have started with a piece of technology, what I call the uterine replicator, which is extrauterine gestation. And so if this were a viable and common technology, what all could people do with it that would be, would generate story or create conflict? And this came, I came up with the idea of the planet of Athos, which is all male, and have eliminated women as, you know, as the source of sin. Yes, they're going to go off and be virtuous. And then, of course, what goes wrong with that scenario becomes the story. And then from that setting came the character Ethan, Dr. Ethan Urquhart, who is works at a reproduction center, rep center, and becomes the hero of that book as he has to go and solve problems. So that was where the character came last in terms of generation. But once he started, began to generate plot around him as he traveled through the story. So it's comes, I started with this system back when I was writing with the two small kids in the house and, you know, no job. And what I would do would be take notes as I went around the house and, you know, did the things you have to do and ran my errands and ran my household. And when they reached a certain amount where I had a scene pretty much blocked out in my mind, I would take it to the Marion Public Library, hire a babysitter or leave the kids with my spouse, then spouse, and write the first draft in longhand. And I could get a few hundred words, you know, per session, you know, sometimes more, and bring these home and then type them onto the computer or the typewriter of the computer in the middle of the chaos, because I could copy without that bubble of silence around me, but I couldn't write first draft.
Right. Is there any particular time, place, or event that generates a new idea? I mean, I ask that because how many people get a good idea in the shower? Yes.
I got a book in the shower.
I have no idea why.
Why in the shower? Well, you're trapped there. You can't go anywhere else. You can't distract yourself with the internet. Yeah.
Yeah.
Although I understand that now there are screens that fit in the shower, which is insane to me. Shower works. I came up with the idea for The Curse of Chalion, which has started a fantasy series for me in the shower, in that very shower, down that hole over there. But I didn't come up with the idea out of nothing. It came out of, you know,
of course,
several things that suddenly cross-connected. So usually what's happening when you get an idea is that you have this whole bag of ideas that are sort of sloshing around loose. The accumulation of everything you've read, everything you've done, experiences, conversations, you name it. And something in there, you know, something drops in and causes things to cross-connect that hadn't been connected before. And the circuit closes and it all lights up and it's ready to go. I can give two examples that I specifically remember. You know, usually it's sort of lost in the shuffle exactly where in the thought stream I came up with the idea, but there are two that I can specifically remember. Both involve water. One was that shower we were just talking about, where I had had taken for fun a course on Spanish medieval history over at the University of Minnesota, just to sort of see if I still had the chops, and was thinking about completing a degree, which I actually never went on to do. But the stories told in that history class, of particularly the reign of Isabella of Castile, were so fascinating. I thought, why isn't anyone stealing this? Yeah, everybody's stealing Arthur. Why and Queen Elizabeth? Why is no one stealing Isabella? Political reasons for that.
Right.
But, yeah. Yeah. But a fantastic tale. And then I had been started a letter game with Pat Reedy, which is a thing where you write back and forth to each other in the persona of a character, and if both of you are novelists, this has a weird tendency to turn into a long narrative thing. Yeah. Mine didn't go very far. It went like about one or two letters and then stopped. Three? Okay. The character was there, but he somehow didn't want to be in that story. You know? So it's this proto-character. He was the Duchess's secretary in this version, a middle-aged guy who'd like been around the block. So that character was sitting there without a story or a setting, and the setting was sitting there without a character or a story for quite a long time. Yeah. And it was just the right moment when I was had finished my other projects and was thinking about it that the two came together.
In the process of writing, even though you have this somewhat structured mythology, do your characters ever speak to you, change, or direct the action themselves? Or are you always in control?
Oh, I'm never in control. The characters have to be what they are. Or what happens is not that my characters run away with the story. It's that they go on sit-down strike.
Yeah.
If I try to push them in a direction that is not right for them, the story kind of grinds to a halt and I'm blocked. And it's like, okay, what's wrong with this? Am I too distracted? Usually it takes a while for me to diagnose, you know, that this is what's going on. There's a lot of reasons to be stalled. If it isn't, I need to clean house, or if it isn't, you know, taking care of this or that peripheral thing. And eventually I come back to face the material itself and say, this story isn't working this way. Usually I go out with my friends and whine at them, you know, this story isn't working. So I think the whining is part of the process as well. But eventually I will sit down and, you know, okay, this isn't working from this point forward. You know, maybe the point at which I stop it, maybe a little sooner. pitch that and go off in the other direction. If it's the right direction, the characters will suddenly leap up and be all full of energy again and ready to rock, doing all the things that they're supposed to be doing. So yeah, my characters tend to be surly and ornery and stubborn, and I think I know where they get it. But
do you have any thoughts along those lines about where it may go? Is there room for science fiction in the future?
I think so. I base this on the fact that people have been bemoaning the death of science fiction since I came in 50 years ago.
Since.
So it's like, okay.
Since
it apparently
Jules
is
Verne.
Always dying and always being reborn. You know, as a new writer comes along who hasn't got the memo and proceeds to write something new and fresh. So no, I don't think it will die. I think the current practitioners all will. You know, eventually we will go and we will be replaced by young people with a whole different set of ideas that make us go, oh no, no. But I don't think it's dying. At the moment, it has gotten very politicized. You know, there used to be more science fiction about science, and there's not as much of that these days. I would like to see more of that. Instead of it all being political metaphors, let's get science back in science fiction. But it's tougher because, first of all, there's more science to know. It's more complex. It's harder to get ahead, even if you interview the practitioners. It's moving so fast. And there's so much of it. And if people want to know about science, they can go on the internet and Google it and find out, you know, lots more, so that interest in science now has enough real sources to feed it that, you know, perhaps the science fiction, you know, isn't doing that as much. I think we still have a place with examining the interface between science fiction and people. It goes back to my talking about being in the 70s and working in the hospital in the 70s and watching the interface between medical technology and people. That interface is still always going to be a problem. So you always want to look at the impact of technology on people, and is where you'll find your stories.
Right.
But yeah, as far as the genre goes, I do not feel that I speak for the genre. I can write my books, and they're like one thread in this big tapestry. But what the whole picture is, I don't have the distance to see.
And then, you know, there you are, not on the cutting edge, but beyond it, obviously, with sci-fi, fantasy, and all. Where do you envision writing to be going? How is this going to play out? Where will we be in 100 years? Will there be writing at all?
I think so. I'm not sure where publishing is going to be.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think that's going to have some changes happening to it. I think writing will be more in the hands of the people than it has ever been before.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we can see that happening now with the internet. Of course, what the people produce is a gigantic slush pile,
right.
Which if you've never had to do with a slush pile, you really don't understand just how bad it can get. So I think that as access to writing and access to getting stuff out there becomes easier and easier, readers are going to want some kind of filtering process to replace what publishers and editors have been doing for them all along that they never appreciated because they never saw it.
Mm-hmm.
They only see the finished product. They don't see all the steps to get there. I think people will still be writing and reading, but the steps from the writer to the reader may take a completely different route. I read a very interesting article by somebody trying to figure out, what is the evolutionary advantage of being able to do, to make art, to make story. And they decided it was like a sexually selected, like antlers, sexually selected thing that, it made people more interesting to each other, and therefore they got a better deal.
I have a different answer.
Yeah.
The ones that do that don't have to work.
Yeah.
They don't have to go out and hunt mastodons. Yeah. They just get to sit there and...
What's an advice for young writers?
Oh, words of advice for young writers.
Snot-nosed, potential,
kids
adoring writer comes up to you.
And how do I do this? Well, the traditional advice hasn't really changed, although the market has changed. Yeah. So when you have specifics of how to break into a particular market, then I don't have up-to-date information at this time, because I'm on the other side of that slope. But write it, finish it, send it out. If you go to Patricia C. Reedy's blog, she will have lots and lots of advice for various writing problems that you can work through if you're analytically minded. But mostly write, sit and write, don't just talk about it. There's also a tricky problem for new writers that each one has to solve as they come to it, I think, of how much and what kind of advice to take and which to say, no, that's not for me. And that's something you have to kind of work out, because some advice is toxic. You can't take every bit of advice that you get. First of all, because some of it's contradictory.
Right.
Right. You can't possibly please all those people. Sometimes because it's it's not what you're trying to do. Sometimes because they don't actually know as much as you do in the first place. So you have to choose your critiquers very carefully and be willing to trade up as you go along. Always find someone who can keep teaching you all the way along.
Wonderful. Thank you ever so much.
You're welcome.
This has been wonderful.